the biggest game changer in terms of just my life as a diabetic was the CGM, once I found that. Because that was really like, okay, I'm not just checking every hour and a half, 2 hours, 4 hours. Hey, I'm feeling tingly, you know, check it there. Hey, I'm sweaty and clammy. It was at constant data, right? I'm getting it every 5 minutes and it's great. And I can see it on my phone and I can see now, instead of just like point A to point B, what's the spike? Is it like straight up and down? Is it kind of slow rise? And just, you have such a better understanding of those kind of inputs and how they affect your body.
I'm Ben Grenell, part of the early startup team here at Levels. We're building tech that helps people to understand their metabolic health, and this is your front row seat to everything we do. This is a whole new level. As we've been building out Levels, we don't often talk about the history of CGM, how it started, what exactly it is, a continuous glucose monitor. We know that people are using it who use Levels. Well, why did continuous glucose monitors start to begin with? Initially, it was technology that allowed people in the type 1 and type 2 community to get insight about their blood sugar, their blood glucose levels in real time. And so having conversations with people in the type 1 and type 2 community is important. On our own team, well, we've got a couple of people who are type 1. And so Jesse Levine, who's part of our ops team and is also type 1, he and Josh Clementi, founder of Levels, the two of them sat down with Chris Trulio. Chris is also part of the type 1 community, and his journey started in his early 20s. He talked a lot about the way that his identity, the way that he thought about living life, the way that things changed, and the way that a CGM allowed him to get more insight into the choices that he made. It was a really meaningful conversation, and it was great to open it up so that Jesse, Josh, and Chris could all dig into this idea of CGM working with the type 1 and type 2 community and how people can get more insight as we start to scale this technology. It was a really meaningful conversation, and it's an important one that we continue to have. Here's where they kick things off.
Thanks both of you for taking some time to dive into this conversation. I think there's obviously a ton of subject matter. And as someone who does not have diabetes, I'm really excited to hear from you all, from your experiences, all the blind spots that I have as someone who has used technology that is traditionally, you know, has been developed for the management of diabetes and has benefited from it tremendously. I'm very grateful that the technology exists. I don't think it would be here if not for the needs of the diabetes community. And I'm really optimistic about the future of connected health, biomonitoring for a whole host of conditions. But in particular, I just would love to hear, you know, I'd love to just start off by hearing some more about, you know, your life experience. I think, Chris, if you want to just tee us off, we kind of connected initially about an open letter that was written from the type 1 diabetes perspective, from your perspective as someone with type 1, two levels, kind of discussing where we are in the arc of technology development and, you know, why there might be some disagreements about how to solve some of the problems that we see and that, you know, the type 1 community faces. So if you want to just give us a little intro on your background and how we got to that point.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think it all starts about 10 years ago. So when I was first actually diagnosed, it was interesting. I had no idea. I probably lived as, I guess, anti-diabetic lifestyle, as you can imagine. You know, there's always that one kind of that one item on the menu, the double cheeseburger with the bacon and the extra loaded fries. And like, that was my go-to. I loved that. I lived for that. And so I was definitely on the other side of the scale of just not eating a healthy lifestyle. And then, but my, you know, I was playing football. I was just like naturally very big, but with a lot of muscle. And I went home one winter break and my mom was like, hey, she noticed some signs that I didn't really catch on. I was just going to the bathroom more often in terms of urinating. I was just drinking a lot of water, like not a normal amount. And she's like, hey, I just want to bring you in. You know, just go to the doctor, get you checked out. And I was like, yeah, sure, mom, whatever. Like, okay, happy to make you happy. And I went in and my blood sugar was through the roof. I think it was like mid 300s or 400. And so they hooked me up to a drip to get me back down. And they said, you know, like, hey, like you have diabetes. It's like very clear that you do at that point. And I've always been a lot more of a just math and numbers guy, and you can't fight math, can't fight the numbers there. I'm just like, okay, and now really looking to like, what's the next step ahead? And from that, I really look at it as like a forced diet. I try to see the silver lining in it and that, okay, now I can't have a sleeve of Oreos, but I can still have two, right? And so like, it's just a lot more rationing in what I'm doing. And how, you know, fast forward about 8 years, how do we get to this point? I was actually working and living with Sam, CEO at Levels, at Kardash. And he had actually, when he had left Kardash and I saw he was starting this company and I was just like, that's interesting. I was like, so is it for diabetics? And he's like, no, it's not actually. And I was like, well, I mean, that could only be a good thing, right? Like I try to stay up on the latest technology with diabetes and just bringing more people to the forefront of awareness of it. There's got to be positives. And so just kind of staying in touch, seeing all that. And then I'd actually saw there was some forum where a lot of type 1 diabetics were bashing Levels. Like, oh, how can you do this? Like, it's so selfish, like just another Silicon Valley scam. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, it's a good thing. Like there's awareness and knowledge of it. And so I was a little bit confused seeing it, but then kind of taking a step back and really thinking about it, I was able to see a lot more, okay, like I can understand where that frustration, that outlash might be coming. And not necessarily as much directly at Levels, but just more a culmination of those kind of experiences that they've had up to date. And so that's as brief of a quick intro into how we get here.
Yeah, that touches many of the main points. And I really appreciate, you know, hearing about the diagnosis story. You know, I'm sure that that's just such a transformative moment. And Jesse, from here, I'd love to hear your background and kind of how you've gotten involved in every aspect of the Levels business as someone who kind of intuitively felt, I think, maybe somewhat similarly to Chris, looking at what Levels is developing. So we'd love to hear your perspective and your background story as well.
Yeah, definitely. First of all, Chris, it's cool to hear that was your first response to Levels, because I definitely share that. So I've been living with type 1 for 16 years. I was diagnosed January 23rd, 2006. It was a very monumental day in my life. And I think every time I tell a story, it's like mostly the same arc, but it's just a little bit tailored to the context. So I think the first half of my time living with diabetes was very much like a compliant patient and doing everything that my doctors told me to do. I was testing my blood sugar 10 to 12 times a day via finger prick. And, you know, my fingers were black and blue, all the things that everyone with type 1 goes through, pre-CGM era, at least. And it wasn't until I went to college where I was like, everybody else is super high functioning around me and I'm like falling asleep in class. And I realized that I needed to like, that CGM was really the roadblock for me, or that type 1 diabetes was really the roadblock for me. I needed to figure it out. I was spiking up to 300 and I'm just like not able to focus and be a high performer that I wanted to be. And so I went back to Houston, and this is really where the second half of my life, or T1D life, started, was when I put in the CGM. And it sounds cliche, but it really was such a game changer. Everything the doctors were telling me to do before was, I found flaws in everything they were telling me. And I was able to experiment with diets. And it was really, I had one endocrinologist who was just a super radical thinker and really helped me view food as medicine. And I took that approach to heart and just started experimenting with a bunch of different diets and finding what worked for me. And then I went back to school and like became this high performer that I wanted to be, and signed up for a bike ride across the country with 20 people all living with type 1. And it was so cool to be this embodiment of like living in the face of my challenges and overcoming them with every step. And then also showing people that they could do the same thing with their condition, whether it's type 1 or another chronic condition or anything else. And so, yeah, so my life has just sort of been a, like since then, it's just been with this a lot of confidence in my back pocket of I can do anything and type 1 is not going to stand in my way. And a lot of the things that I learned with CGM, I see a lot of things like a lot of the tiredness and sluggishness mirrored in people across the table from me, whether it's my family or friends. And, you know, we have a big type 2 dinner and they're like, I need to take a nap. And I'm like, oh, your blood sugar is probably high. And then I found Levels, and I'm like, I'm doing my master's in public health degree and I'm trying to figure out like, how can I make an impact in the world? And as soon as I found Levels, I was like, this is it. I have to join this team. And I got got connected with Josh, and everything that this team is doing so far is just like above and beyond any expectations that I've had of just expanding the awareness of metabolic health. It's expanded my knowledge of metabolic health, and I've implemented definitely different behaviors and tactics to manage my diabetes from what Mike Haney has put in the blog. And that's a nutshell. I think that's probably a good place to start.
Yeah, thanks for the background there, Jesse, as well. And you know what really stuck out to me there, and Chris, I'd love to hear your perspective on this as well, is Jesse, you mentioned that there was an individual, like one person, probably an endocrinologist, I believe, who was sort of a free thinker and was breaking the mold in how they were approaching treatment or the advice they were giving for treatment and lifestyle. And I'm curious how consistent that is, where you had a breakthrough as a result of one sort of stalwart, one person who was willing to break the mold. And that had a lot of downstream effects, it seems, in the way that you approach your lifestyle and how you manage your condition. Chris, is something similar there? I'd love to hear about that. And also how tools that give you a substrate of information that you can work from have changed that situation. In other words, do you now depend on finding that one individual who thinks more openly and considers your personal perspective? Or does having technology, you know, has that changed the paradigm a little bit and given more leverage to you as opposed to relying on others?
Yeah. And I really think it goes back to when I was first diagnosed. I went on the pump after 10 days. I was like, this sucks. I don't want to be giving myself shots in my arm. I don't want to be giving myself shots in my stomach. Like, I just, as I kind of said before, like, I like to eat. And so for me, that's just like, that's kind of a non-starter. And so I was like, well, this pump, like, it sounds great. Like, I don't have to think about it. It's just a lot more, it's a math problem. You know, what's coming in, what needs to get adjusted for and corrected. And so that on the pump side, I'd say allowed me to live as closely to what things were like before being diagnosed. And I can't even imagine how people must have done it, you know, like 30, 40 years ago. I really can't. And it just gives, like, the technology is so freeing to be able to have that. And yeah, I'd say my parents have always just fully supported me at that. They're like, hey, whatever's really best. They've kind of stayed up on top of what technologies are there as well. Always pushing and asking my endocrinologist as well. But I would say that in terms of with an endocrinologist, they move at your speed. So they understand what your comfort levels are. And mine knew that I was very aggressive in, you know, wanting to try new things, wanting to test it out, wanting to go get, you know, do like an evaluation to see how different inputs affect different blood sugar levels. And I think that's because I was so open to it, where I was diagnosed at 20 years old. So I didn't grow up with it. I kind of grew up, I'd say, you know, a normal life from that regard. And so when it came, it was like, okay, how do I get back to living that normal way? Whereas if I was diagnosed at 3, 5, 8 years old, that would be the only thing I knew. And so it's just a different mindset of how do I just kind of always try to live a normal life? And I think that's what influences a lot of why I don't, you know, like the first thing I say is not that I'm a type 1 diabetic, right? I just kind of, people that know me or are close to me know that, but I'd say the majority of people that I know, like, don't actually know of my condition. I kind of do it more on a need to know basis, mainly because I just don't feel like, I don't walk up to someone like, hey, like, I'm a straight white male that's married, right? Like, it's just things that, like, don't need to say unless it's kind of that context is brought up. But yeah, when I think was the biggest game changer in terms of just my life as a diabetic too, was when the CGM, once I found that, because that was really like, okay, I'm not just checking every hour and a half, 2 hours, 4 hours. Hey, I'm feeling tingly, you know, check it there. Hey, I'm sweaty and clammy. Now I check it. It was that constant data, right? I'm getting it every 5 minutes and it's great. And I can see it on my phone and I can see now, instead of just like point A to point B, what's the spike? Is it like straight up and down? Is it kind of slow rise? And just, you have such a better understanding of how your actions and what those kind of inputs, how they affect your body. Because yeah, like seeing, okay, if I eat this food, I know when to take this insulin. I know, you know, what kind of activity that I'm going to be doing later. It just gives you so much more control over it, so that I know if, hey, I'm going to be going on a big hike, I can leave my sugar a little bit high. So that way it doesn't go low 20 minutes into the hike. Or if my sugar is high, like, maybe I'll go get some activity And then it'll help to naturally bring that down as well. And so it just helps to bring a lot more, say, natural controlled remedies rather than just like mashing the button on my pump, giving myself more insulin, because I know that that's going to be like, it's like the opposite of instant gratification. Like I know that in 90 to 120 minutes, I'm going to have to like take the repercussions for those actions. Like there's going to be some adjustment. Is it not enough? Is it too much? Is it just right? Like every day and every minute is like a Goldilocks math calculation. Am I having just enough food? Am I having just enough insulin? Am I having just enough exercise, but all working in a timely manner and making sure that everything is, you know, kind of clicking at the same time. Even for this call, I have a packet of sugar next to me in case my sugar happens to go low. Like I can be able to get it up in a quick way. And so it's just no matter what you're doing, you're always thinking, constantly thinking about it. And I think just the best way to be able to live as normal life is like, yeah, the adoption of these kind of technologies, having that data, it gives you a lot more control of it. And then on the other end of that is being prepared for it. I know if I'm going on a road trip, like have sugar, have things with me. If I'm going on a hike or going camping or I'm going wherever, like have those things to make sure that, you know, in the event of XYZ, okay, there's, you know, I have every contingency planned for, and kind of being able to standardize that and make it easily travelable, accessible, really helps.
There's so much there. I have so many questions, and I definitely want to, make sure that Jesse is able to raise some of the, I think maybe discuss some of those key points that you raised. Most specifically, I think the identity formation piece, you know, you touched on something about like sort of a late diagnosis. Type 1 previously was called juvenile diabetes. I think it had like sort of that name, and which didn't really apply because there is this late diagnosis even well into adulthood, which happens. And so, yeah, that identity formation piece is so interesting and unique. But then also all of this technology development, you know, it leads to a whole host of questions I've got on many things, but financial, I think political, there's just a whole network of questions that arise there because you just touched on all of the ways in which this technology benefits you. And then that opens just such a can of worms because how can we both have that be true and then also have challenges of accessibility that are so strong? So I want to get to that. But the thing that stands out to me most as someone who does not have diabetes is the consistency and dedication that it takes every single day to manage the condition. It's so hard, I think, for people to understand that until you start to get an insight into the dynamics of the human body. Most people, I think, feel that everything is static. Like basically the human body stays the way it is for most of the time. And then there will be a change. You'll feel hunger and then you'll eat something and then it's back to normal. The reality is that, like you said, everything you do, you get on your bike to ride to class, that's a huge event. And I never had an appreciation for this until speaking with, you know, people who are living with type 1 in particular, because they truly are as close to cyborg sort of perspectives as I've heard, which is that they're so in tune, they have such strong interoception that even without the CGM, they're able to know almost exactly where things are now and where they're going. And so anyway, I'm just blown away by that, especially when you start to get into the lifestyles that are even more challenging, you know, the athletic side of things, the really high performers who are also, you know, consistently doing everything that everyone else in their field is doing, but then also dealing with essentially manually controlling. It's like taking the plane off autopilot and taking the stick over and like controlling the airplane. It's really, I just want to say that an outside observer, it blows my mind consistently that degree of control and interception. So I'd love to circle back and talk about identity formation. And Jesse, you gave us your background. Chris, you gave us yours. And I'm curious about the sort of different perspectives and how identity formation plays into your lives and whether or not, for example, type 1 is considered a badge of honor versus something that you share with your closest circle.
Yeah, I think so, Chris. I'm curious. I'm going to form this as a question. You said that type 1 diabetes isn't a part of how you introduce yourself. It's just part of who you are, and it only comes up on a need-to-know basis. But you're also diagnosed at 20, so you had like a pretty well-established normal before this point of your diagnosis. And I think that's a lot different from where I'm coming from. So I'm curious, like, how that plays into your identity with type 1 of like having lived a life before, or a great number of years before getting diagnosed, and then having this massive change where you have to think about all the time.
I look at it as, you know, you got to play the hand you're dealt. everyone has their own situation. And for me, you know, for the first 20 years of my life, I never had to, I didn't even know what glucose or blood sugar were. And I could really kind of, I could have whatever diet or lifestyle I want. And I was lucky to still be healthy. You know, I was able to balance it out with exercise, just kind of being young. And once I found that out, you know, I wanted to do everything that I could to not negatively change my life. And so I really look at it as like, I look at it as a silver lining. I mean, since getting diabetes, it's by far the last 10 years of my life were way healthier than, you know, the 10 prior, just because I actually like a lot more management, a lot more just keeping things in check and being a lot more intentional about my diet, intentional about working out and not just kind of, you know, doing whatever I want to in that minute, but being able to like have those, that longer term point of view. And I really look at it as like, I want to, you know, I want to live to be 80, 90, 100, 110. And so what do I got to do today? It's especially on the type one side, what I think is the most comforting for me is just knowing that it's not my fault. I could have lived the healthiest life, right? I could have lived the worst life. And no matter what, it would have still happened. It was just a matter of time. And I think for me, it gives me a lot of solace to know that, you know, I got to enjoy a life like that. And now going forward, I get to enjoy a different life. And I think what probably the biggest, I guess, identity part of that is 2 years ago, I was diagnosed with celiacs. And as a diabetic, I could still have wheat. So I could still have a pizza. I could still have beer. I could still have a bagel. It really sucks to have that, you know, because it really affects your sugar for 4, 6, 8 hours afterwards, but I could still have it. And so now, when I go into a doctor for regular routine diabetic blood work, I realized that I just felt like crap for the year, you know, the 18 months prior. And I was just attributing that to, oh, I'm stressed from work. Oh, just so much is kind of going on. And when they said it was celiacs, I was like, oh, it makes sense. And I guess with my previous experience of being a diabetic, it's like, I trust science. I trust numbers. And so if these numbers on my blood panel are high, and that's like because of celiacs, I was like, well, okay, I probably have it, but I want to make sure because it's a big decision. And so I got an endoscopy a week later. I was like, let's do it. Like if that's what it needs to be to confirm, and they confirmed it. And so, all right, I just immediately went 100% gluten-free. Like I'm not messing with anything. And what's nice is it's actually the best my numbers have ever been. So there's just a lot with wheat that isn't not good for diabetics. And so it's actually helped to keep things a lot more stabilized in that more controlled diet environment. And once again, I always frame it as it's a forced diet. It's a good thing. You know, I have to eat healthier, but it's not by choice. Are there some times when I'm out and I'd love a nice, you know, just a really big chocolate cake dessert or the garlic bread that comes up before? Of course, that'd be awesome. But my diabetes and celiac say no. And so kind of just listening, and it listens to your body. Like I feel so much better. And I think just with my general personality and how I want to be, I want to feel good. I want to be happy. I want to just like enjoy my time, enjoy the people that I'm with. And by doing that, it's keeping my numbers like, you know, as flat as possible and not taking in gluten because both of those, they make me feel bad. And so I want to minimize the time that I feel bad and maximize the time that I feel good.
Jesse, I'm curious your perspective, if it differs, if it's similar. I'm really, you know, the celiac link is so interesting and it leads to many other downstream questions, but Jesse, anything to share from your perspective there?
Yeah, I definitely relate to you on the feel good part. You live your life and you tailor your life to feel good. And also the other part I really relate to is viewing diabetes as a silver lining. I think that's when Josh said the word badge of honor earlier, like that's really where it comes in for me as like, after I got to the point where I started to manage my diabetes well and take control of it, and not let it control me, it made me realize that because of this data that I'm taking and because of this lifestyle that I'm tailoring towards having stable numbers, I'm probably living so much healthier than if I were on a regular course of the rest of like the average American.
And insane.
Just because I'm so, yeah, just because I'm so in tune with what I'm putting in my body and the pizza. I love pizza, but I can't really eat it. Like I can, but it's not worth it. And you said something that made me laugh out loud in your letter, which was that you can eat a box of pizza and take insulin and watch the whole Lord of the Rings trilogy and have less resolution than Frodo. And that just, it's so true. There's no way to know what's going to happen in your body because it's such a, you eat pizza, for example, this is like, could be sushi or any other carbs with a fat and protein component to it as well. And it's just a ticking time bomb of carbs and you have no idea how to time it. If it's at nighttime, it's different. If I'm ever going to eat like a piece of pizza or sushi, it's going to be that I know I have like a long walk afterwards or like I'm walking to and from dinner because otherwise it's just not controllable for me and I'm going to feel bad and I'm going to be a cranky, not very nice Jesse to anybody else around me. And that's not who I want to be. That's not who I'm becoming.
The first word that comes to mind with pizza is headache. And like, that shouldn't be what it is, right? It should be delicious, cheese, pepperoni, not like nightmare, right? And that's just like, that's what it ends up being is that, you know, those, you want to avoid putting yourself voluntarily into those situations or, hey, I'm getting the best pizza in town. So like, I'm going to enjoy. And you're making that deliberate decision to enjoy. And it makes any kind of, it makes your relationship with food, it has to be a lot more intentional.
I've had many pizzas too, where I've scraped all the toppings off and people around me, and I just leave the crusts and the bread on the table. People are like, what are you doing? I just show them my arm and I'm like, I have different needs than you do.
I'm really curious. This is maybe a little bit complex, but I've thought a lot about, as I've learned more about diabetes and truly there, we have this name diabetes for a whole spectrum of conditions, which are very different. And so looking at the spectrum today of we'll call metabolic dysfunction and diabetes, such a vast majority of it is a different variety, which is lifestyle-induced chronic illness, type 2 diabetes. And I have this thought that I'd love to hear some of your perspectives on around type 1 versus type 2 and how the different mindsets play out, where what you both just talked about is that the silver lining of type 1 is that it forces a reality and an immediacy and almost an acuteness to decisions that you're making, you know, even pizza and pizza nights versus more of the type 2, which is a very slow. And I wonder if it's less immediate implications of that condition allow for a longer, slower sort of playing out of the condition where the complications might actually get worse in the long run because, you know, you're able to sort of ignore the acuteness. There's no immediate risk. And for those listening, the difference between the two conditions is insulin production. So with type 1, exogenous insulin is used, so injections or pumps to essentially supplement the body when the pancreas no longer produces insulin, whereas with type 2 diabetes, it typically is an uncoupling of insulin production versus glucose management, so it's insulin resistance. And that allows for a situation where with exogenous insulin, there can be hypoglycemic events where if it's mismanaged, blood sugar can go very low and that can be acutely dangerous. So that's to set the stage. I'm just curious about your perspectives there about the immediacy and the differences between that sort of spectrum of outcomes.
I think the biggest difference is type 1, you don't see it coming. There's nothing, there's no rhyme or reason. There is no cause and effect. Where with type 2, there is more cause and effect. And that's why I'm not saying I was like, you know, I wasn't like obese or anything. But when I was diagnosed with type 1, like, I think that's part of why when you talk about identity formation, I kind of separate, like, usually the first thing to say is like, oh, but it's type 1. Like, you know, it wasn't by choice. And so that's where I think just in those differences, when you've made those decisions for so many years, and there usually are warning signs. If you go to the doctor and you get an A1C check, like, you'll be pre-diabetic, which means like, hey, like if you continue this, you will become full-blown diabetes. Whereas with type 1, it's one day, it's it. Like there's no warnings, no slap on the wrist, no, hey, you need to get your life back. You know, no, it's like you are diabetic and it's a life sentence. And that's what I think is kind of most jarring. And it's like, okay, Jesse, I think you said it great where you said, you know, kind of like, pre, before, after, like on that big day, because your life does change on that day. And it's absolutely you have no say in it. But you do have a say in how you react to it. Like anything that you would have done in the past wouldn't change the fact that you're diabetic. But you can totally manage what the rest of your life looks like. And I think that's where at least on the type one side, you're able to see the implications of if you don't manage it, you don't feel well, you're just not yourself around people. And so being able to, like, basically, how do you want to respond? How do you want to take control over something that you had absolutely no control in it playing a part of your life?
I think I would add something onto that too, is that type one does hit you in a moment. Like, you're not expecting it at all, unless you have someone who's like trained to watch for the warning signs. I think it's also largely true for type 2 diabetes as well. And a lot of the population is that, or pre-diabetes, you know, that's sort of the warning sign for type 2, but you go to the doctor and you think that you're healthy and then like, bam, you have a diagnosis. And it's like, to what Josh was saying, like the effects are much less noticeable because they're like, they just sort of build up over many, many years and they're much more chronic. Whereas type one sort of just kind of happens more instantly. I guess that's the differentiation. Like, type one happens more instantly than type two, and prediabetes build up over a long period of time. But in terms of like the naming convention, Josh, you and I have shared notes over this, that it is confusing because this is like, for me, I do introduce myself a lot as the fact that I have type 1 diabetes, and it just comes up naturally because I wear my Dexcom G6 on my arm, and people are oftentimes asking me what that is. And I'll tell them, I'll walk into the whole rig rundown. I'll show them my Tandem T-Slim pump that connects to it, and then like really tell them the differences between type 1 and type 2. And those are usually the first questions that they have. And so I think that from what I've experienced in my time within the diabetes community, type one specifically, is that there's a lot of like resistance, or yeah, I wouldn't say resistance, but there's like a protective nature over being a type one. And it's like very much drawing a moat around what this disease is. And if anybody with type two says, I can relate to you, they're like, no, you don't have the same disease at all. But I think that they do actually share a lot of differences. And because the naming conflates, and because the CDC only presents the data in a way that it says like 10% of Americans have diabetes, and it doesn't give an actual breakdown of what those are, what the numbers are, and actually, like, you know, 30 million plus have type 2 diabetes, but 1.5 have type 1, it sort of loses the specialness that you feel, because you do have to do all of these micro calculations at every moment of every day, whereas someone with type 2, at least the traditional way of managing it, isn't taught, or you're not taught to micromanage it in the way that you need to with type one. And I think that probably there needs, like, that needs to change as well, because type two can be better managed in the way that we're telling people to manage it. And that's I see levels having a big part in that. That's how I view the two different diseases. And I think that better, more distinct separation would probably go a long way in like helping the two groups work together, or like knowing who is helping who and for what purpose.
There's a pretty, I'd say, isolating moment during the early days of the pandemic, when it's like, hey, there's going to be a vaccine that's coming out. And in California, the early thing said, okay, it's going to be frontline workers, and then it's going to be high risk people with people with diabetes. And then when it actually came out, it was people with type 2 diabetes. Type 1 wasn't eligible. And it's like, so now you're going to, it was just something where it's like, oh, okay. So like that's really like, they're just seeing it as so different from there. That's where it's kind of like, I could see it as, you know, it's like, hey, like your side versus your side, right? Like you just kind of take your stance where it's like, that's something where people want to get so crazy in the early days. Like you're basically told, oh, sorry, your disease isn't a disease enough.
Interesting. I'm curious about the underlying logic of that. Is that something about, okay. I wonder if it was something around potential complications or something like that. That's curious. I didn't hear about that. Yeah. It's really interesting. All of the, you know, when you get deeper into the space and you recognize just how different these conditions truly are, it is interesting that we've applied a single label to them. I think it doesn't do anyone any good to not have more clarity, because certainly as it relates to management, you know, you can lifestyle manage type 2 to a significant extent. And Virta Health and others have done some pretty amazing work showing that efficacy can be very high for even just like diet controlled type 2. But you know, I'm curious about both of you, your experiences so far with lifestyle management and how effective it can be relative to, well, I would say just overall, how effective is lifestyle management? And have you tried any specific techniques, anything that has worked super well to give you control and maybe like lean off dependency on other outside management techniques like insulin?
Especially when I'll get a really good streak of eating well, having good, healthy exercise. It's a very humbling experience to know that there's literally not even no days off, like no hours or seconds or minutes off, where if you forget to give yourself insulin, even late for one meal, your sugar will shoot right back up. And so that's where you truly know that it is a 24/7 lifestyle management tool. I think for me, one thing I started doing, I'd actually started doing it trying to get into a good diet for my wedding, was I did intermittent fasting. And I just saw it was incredible because the last meal I would have would be dinner. And then, you know, not eating for whatever it is, 12, 16 hours, that's basically just flat. And it really helped me to know, okay, my basal rates are what the kind of constant insulin that's given to you, that's staying flat. And I think that was one of the biggest helps, drinking a lot of water. And I know it sounds simple, but like that helps incredible, getting just a normal amount of, like a good amount of sleep. I go for a walk every morning. I actually try to, first thing when I wake up, I try to go for a 2 to 4 mile walk. And that just sets my day completely right. Like I can tell if I don't get that morning exercise, and it's not rigorous, right? I'm walking. My levels are always elevated for the rest of the day. And then on that last kind of component is limiting how many carbs I have with dinner. And so the nights where I have like, if I have like a salad or a very just like wholesome, very not carb heavy dinner, it just keeps things so much more steady. And so you're not trying to correct bigger swings, but just the steadier you can keep it of limiting that late night, because then it keeps your, you know, it all just snowballs on one each other where, okay, if my sugar is high going to bed, then it's high while I sleep. And maybe it's high when I wake up. And now I'm playing an up and down game from the moment I wake up. And that just sucks. No one likes that. But if it stays steady when I'm going to bed, then steady while I'm sleeping, steady when I wake up, I can ride that all the way through to lunch. That's incredible, right? Like I'm able to have that half a day plus more of just consistent levels where I'm not giving myself any insulin outside of that basal. It's nice. That's what I mean. Like it's an incredible feeling to like not have to really worry about it. But then you have a nice big lunch and it's like, oh, okay, no, yeah, it's still there, no matter what I'm doing. But you can at least like take as many steps to help support for as long of the day as possible.
Yeah, walking is also a big one for me, and intermittent fasting has been a really big and very cool unlock for me, because there was a long time, and this is probably pre-CGM and pre-insulin pump for me, but where I thought that I wasn't able to fast because I have diabetes, and like for fear of just not having insight into my levels and maybe having a potential seizure after that. And you always hear that the traditional side of things is don't fast. You need the carbs. And that's sort of where I was coming from and weaning myself off of. But with a lot of micro experience, I was able to realize that, oh, this actually does, this is probably the most effective thing towards keeping my glucose stable, is not eating. And I tested a lot of different lifestyle things, ranging from diet, like I was vegan for 6 months and then immediately switched over to keto. There were a lot of really good meals and recipes that I've learned from those diets that I still use today, but I'm not like extreme on any one approach right now. And I built a toolkit of like how to navigate different circumstances. If I'm going to be biking for the whole day, that's a different story. And if I'm going to be sitting at my computer and working for the whole day, that's also a different story. So a lot of it, and I want to touch on this component because I feel like it's important for people as they're implementing lifestyle changes, is that if you find something that works, you feel like you need to do it nonstop. And if you miss a day, it's like, oh, I failed. And I've had a lot of those experiences where I have a really good streak of blood sugars, and then I forget to take insulin for a meal or take it 5 minutes late. And then I'm like at 250 and my whole world has just dropped. It's like, oh my God, now the next 12 hours or 24 hours or however long is, it just feels like it's ruined. And I like, you know, there's a lot of self-forgiveness that I've learned throughout the years living with type one. And that, again, like I didn't ask to have type one and I do the best I can. And so, yeah, I just wanted to touch on that component because I think it's important to like forgive yourself if you mess up sometimes. And tomorrow's a new day and tomorrow's a new like reset of insulin sensitivity, unless you've had pizza overnight, in which case you probably need it. But for now, I also drink a lot of water. A lot of things that I've picked up, I've learned since reading the Levels blog, which are to walk after meals. That's been a huge help for me. I've been eating a lot of chia seed pudding. That's like the first thing I eat in the morning. And yeah, I'm either intermittent fasting or eating chia seed pudding first thing. And my blood sugars are super stable after that. And then also like really ordering the fats and proteins before the carbs. And a lot of times once I get to the carbs, I'm like, I don't even want this. I don't know why I bolus for this, but now I have to eat it because I've already taken insulin.
So interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it really, it goes to the immediacy and constant nature of what you all are doing every day. I want to take a slight pivot and sort of transition over to what the initial sort of conversation that Chris, you helped weigh in on was focused on, which really is about, I think, the challenges that are asymmetric that people with diabetes are dealing with. And in particular, I want to talk about the financials of living with type 1. So we've talked about all of the lifestyle and social implications and identity implications, but I want to talk about financial specifically because it is one of the areas that is just so asymmetric right now. And so can you take us through some of, you know, what it's like living with type 1 when it comes to money and cost, you know, what you're dealing with on a month-to-month basis?
It's a pretty financially crippling disease, not going to lie. I mean, my wife will joke sometimes when I leave the house, she's like, oh, you going to go pick up another prescription? Like, just like walk by CVS just because, you know, which one is it this time? And because insurance never lines up how you want it to, you can't pick them all at once. That'd be too easy. And you can't be all in the same, like it can't be a 30-day or 90-day, like everything's unique based on insurance, based on the generic, based on what's there. And so it's as much prepare as much as you can, but you just know something's going to mess up. And so like, I think an underlying thing of it, which is just like a pretty kind of grim reality is you need health. I mean, I know whether kind of laws and regulations, but like you need health insurance. Like you can't afford not to have health insurance, which if you don't have a spouse, that means you probably need to be working for however long to be able to pay for it. Between you have, you know, a new insulin pump, you'll have the vials of insulin, the pump supplies of the catheters, the reservoirs, test strips, lancets. There's two or three more for the CGM. And so that's 8 separate prescriptions, which can be across however many different companies. And if you run out of one, you need them all. It's like you can't drive a car with 3 wheels. You need to have everything there. Then maybe this time you run out of gas, or maybe this time your lights don't work. And that's just to keep things as going as normal as possible. But I mean, like, yeah, without insurance, I think I have some numbers here. Like a new pump would be probably 2,000 to 5,000 every 4 years. Insulin vials, a 30-day supply. I've gotten charged 600 before when I needed to buy them on vacation emergency. Just catheters and insulin reservoirs, you're talking about 700 to 1,000 for a 30-day supply. Test strips, 150 to 300 for a 30-day supply. CGM sensors can be 350 for a 30-day supply. Transmitters, you know, 450 to 900 for a 2-month supply. So you're looking at an out-of-pocket cost of roughly 2,000 to 2,700 per month. Like that is as bad as the housing market can be in San Francisco. You can get a nice place for that, right? Like it's insane. And so that's on top of living a normal life expenses of everything, of saving for retirement, all that. Like, so you have to be not only is it just a every second of your life managing the disease, you also have to be fiscally responsible. Otherwise, you know, you're going to have to make hard decisions of, do I cut insulin or do I cut dinner or what, like, what do you cut this week if you're not?
That last point is just, it's kind of chilling, you know, to imagine having to make a decision between a life or death medication or a meal.
I personally am fortunate to never have had to make that decision, and I'm very grateful for that. But one thing that Chris mentioned is, like, because these costs are so expensive, you really do have to have health insurance. And like, that was a big part of my turning 26. I was like contracting for a fine dining restaurant in Chicago and also trying to start my own diabetes education app. And as soon as my birthday hit, I was like, okay, I'm off my parents' insurance, which I've been riding comfortably on for this whole time. And yeah, shit gets real. Like I had to find a job, and that's where the search started. And luckily I found something that was so aligned with my values. But yeah, that's like a very, like, not only is it taking away from like other, is it on top of other costs of living in terms of rent or food, or if you're investing for the future or anything like that, but it also changes the course of your life. Like my entrepreneurial journey got cut short because of the need to have insurance. And I have another friend who is in the type 1 space, and he turned 26, and he told his business partner, they were like doing a marketing startup. He was like, yeah, I've got 3 months worth of pump supplies left. Let's do this thing. Let's hustle. And they made it work. And now he's got a really cool, successful company. But these things are very real thoughts, and you can't really like neglect to consider them before choosing your life course.
Yeah. I mean, beyond the order of magnitude of those costs that people are having to shoulder indefinitely, this is chronic, but also the opportunity cost of having to make decisions about lifestyle, about the career path you take, about the risks you take, because there are alternatives that, besides just having the income generating power to be able to cover those costs in the first place, all of the other potential investments, vacations, you know, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, it's just such a tremendous, I'd love to hear from your perspectives what the great challenges are that the community faces in tackling this problem. Like, where are these challenges rooted, and what do you see as the most important changes that have to be made so that this can be different going forward?
I think a big piece of it is education and information sharing. Like, you don't know if, are you picking the right insurance plan to help optimize? Are you picking the right supplies that are going to be covered? Are you picking the pump or the CGM or whatever it might be that you're used to, that you're comfortable with using? Is that going to be covered when you transfer insurances? How much does it cost if you have to buy it out of pocket in an emergency situation? Like, where can you access it? I know for my CGM, one of the craziest things was, you can't buy it directly from them anymore. Like, you can only buy it with a prescription. And so, like, in an emergency situation, I actually know of someone that they had to go to a 24-hour pharmacy at 3 a.m. because their son's CGM like died and they needed to get another one. So to get like that CGM, they had to basically get an emergency authorization prescription because you can't buy it like over the counter, when it just makes no sense. And so, like, you're on your own for so much of it. And I think that's where, like, you're on your own to figure out, because it is a personalized situation of, okay, what pump do you use? What insulin? What testing strip? What CGM? And then, like, layer that with what's your insurance. And just think, like, if you're a healthy person with nothing, insurance is confusing. Now imagine you have like this, just like thousands of, you know, potentially out of pocket expense per month. You have no idea making that decision in a 2 week timeframe in November, you know, when you're probably thinking about the holidays and not scrubbing through insurance plans. So you really have to prioritize every single aspect of putting your diabetes first, or at least just like investing that time, carving it out, because no one's going to do it for you. And like, the implications could be, okay, now you're paying way more for the next 12 months until next year.
Yeah, I think that's like a very important and immediate step. I think like at the root cause is just the costs of insulin and supplies in general. like Chris, you touched on this on your letter, like once you're diagnosed with type one, you are locked in to these big behemoth companies' markets. And like they have total say over what prices they put on it. And so a month's worth of insulin can cost $600 to $900, or even more in some cases. But it's just like you look at other countries and that's not how it is. Like I'm in Mexico right now and I can go buy a vial of insulin for like $30 over the counter. And, I may do that because before I go back, just to stock up. Because, and there's also another thing too, of like when you get a prescription written, you say, I need this much insulin. And I always say, I need more insulin than I do so I can have a little bit of extra in case of emergency. A vial breaks, one goes bad in the sun. I'm traveling and I need to have extras in case those things happen abroad and I can't access them except if I'm in Mexico and I can buy them on the counter.
The insurance needs to be renewed. That's what I think is like, I've had gaps in coverage, which is insanity. It's like, okay, sorry, my 12 refills for my insulin. Now I need to like get a new prescription. It's like, nothing's changed. I'm still a diabetic. Like, why do you need to like, it's not like it hasn't been resolved. I still need all of these supplies. And so like, just to be able to have it on autopilot like that, like the fact that there even on that has to be a refill on it, you know, it's like, oh, maybe your doctor's out of town. Maybe you're out of town. And just like all those little hiccups can really compound.
Yeah. And one other micro thing too with insurance and prescriptions is that your insurance has total control over what brand of insulin you get. So if you're on Novolog and this works for you and they're like, oh, we're going to switch you over to Humalog. It's been described to me as Pepsi and Coca-Cola, but it's not. They are very different for some people. Some people have an allergy to some. Some people have like need double the amount of one or the other. And so it's a complete life adjustment whenever you get this insurance letter that says, hey, we made the decision from our executive team that we're going to switch you over to this other insulin. Have a happy life.
So, you know, I see a lot of challenges in the US healthcare system specifically and with the three-party insurance mechanism, which unfortunately I think creates, although well-intentioned and certainly important to make sure that there is coverage, it's also in some ways shrouding the true cost because there's no real market happening here where a price is set and a product is purchased. And I'm curious about your perspectives on direct purchases and how that might change, you know, how all of these things might change if there was more direct accountability from manufacturer to consumer in this case. And of course it's a patient relationship and this is healthcare. And these are things that we shouldn't necessarily have to think about in traditional marketing terms, but I am curious about your thoughts about the direct transaction and whether that would change if the insurance party wasn't in the loop.
If I could rip out the insurance as part of the equation, I would do it in a second. But I've paid for, I think, just about everything out of pocket. And I know, like, why would I ever want to do that? If the costs were reasonable, like, it would be incredible. Like, it would just make things so much easier. You could buy it on your own terms. You can buy however long of a supply you feel comfortable with. Do you want to have a shelf worth of supplies in your apartment? Or do you want to have a full closet full? Just because of what the insurance and deductibles, like being able to like take advantage of that when you can, because usually you can't. But on the other side, for the manufacturers, there's no incentive for them to lower prices, right? It's like a diabetic patient is a cash cow that they're going to be healthy for the next 60 years of their life. And so why not? They are a recurring customer every month without fail, unless insurance knocks them off or if they find a different product, which there have been new technologies, don't get me wrong. But in terms of like, Jesse, I don't know about you. Once I find something that works, I don't want to switch. Like, you know, my doctor will come with, hey, if like you thought about this, I'm like, I'm happy. Like I have it, it's stable, we're good. Like why switch up a good thing? Like I want to stay as steady as possible. For new technologies, for sure. I'll be first in line. Like I want to try anything that's new. But when you're comparing alternatives, it's okay, if cost is the same, accessibility is the same, like if it's just like, hey, maybe different preference here or there, there's no incentive to do that.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. And I think in a lot of cases, insurance doesn't quite understand the full extent of the disease, or they view it as a very generic. Like if you have more insulin needs than the next person, or you need more test strips because you want to check your blood sugar more, they're going to say, oh, we only will give you 8 as opposed to 15 you asked for. And if you're trying to do like, you know, be your own CGM, like you're out of luck. Sorry. But so yeah, I would love to buy it direct over the counter for both insulin and CGMs. That would be awesome. And I just thought of something too that goes back to your question earlier of lifestyle changes that have impacted by management. And a lot of them from intermittent fasting to being more conscientious of the ordering of my macronutrients when I'm intaking them have decreased my insulin needs a lot. And so from the time when I was first diagnosed, like I was told to eat 90 grams of carbs per meal. And I take one unit of insulin for every 10 grams of carbs. So that's 9, you know, that's 9 units per meal, probably more because I'm going to have to take a correction dose because there's no way that those 9 units are going to cover all of that with, you know, more insulin resistance over time. And so that's 27 units per day. And that's only short acting. And that's not including snacks or anything. So let's just say like 60 units per day of short acting, just to double that, because that's like usually what I was taking. After all of my lifestyle changes and really like taking a hard look at my lifestyle, I'm taking sometimes 20 to 35 units a day, which is around half of what I was taking before. And that's pretty staggering. And like, there are ways to sort of hack the system, which I think about a lot. Like if I'm asking my doctor to write me a prescription for insulin, I will ask for that 60 units because I know that I'll only use half of that. And then I can store the rest away for a rainy day. So yeah, I would love to not have to think about like hacking or like telling my doctor or the insurance companies that I need more than I use. And I would just be able to buy what I need over the counter when I need it, as opposed to like waking up a doctor at 3 a.m. to write me a new prescription and authorize something because something got messed up in the system.
You should need to refill 30-day supply on day 30. You should be able to have that kind of leeway time, but insurance will have so many hurdles that often don't let that be feasible.
Yeah, it's I'm curious about, like, insulin is such a difficult one because it is, you know, the patent was initially published open source. It was put out there for the public. And the intention was not that this be an income generating prospect. And now, you know, here we are where you're locked into a cadence of availability and a fixed chemistry that you have to, you know, it's the only one that the insurance will cover. Are there any other ways that you all know about that this problem can be more openly discussed and more readily tackled? Yeah, I'm just curious your thoughts. Insulin is such a difficult problem and such a unique one. Any thoughts on this one?
I think that the way that we are doing it now at Levels of empowering everybody with their own data, not just people with type 1, is it makes the conversation much easier. Like if I'm talking to a person without diabetes who's worn a CGM before, there are so many more relatable points to have in that conversation than someone who has never worn a CGM and thinks that the conversations that I'm having about diet and food are only relevant to me because I have diabetes. And so that's one thing. And that's like, it feels maybe small, but it's just such a nice relief to have that conversation. And I'll give an example of that. Like we had a Friday fireside a few months, like around when I joined, almost, I guess, like 9 months ago, where the whole Levels team was just so curious to hear my experience and Alan's experience with type 1. And it was so, like, I still think about that with chills, because it was just such a cool experience to have people genuinely listening and curious about what my experience was like. And so going back to the big picture is like having people be able to relate to these experiences and the foods that are causing these energy deficiencies in me and in you, we can have a common conversation around like how to better fix the food system and how to better like lower the cost of CGMs because everyone needs them. And I just think that like more and more of these conversations are important, and more people, the more people who have access to their data and the more people who realize that everything in the middle of a grocery store is not good for them and not optimal for their health is going to change the paradigm overall. And I know a lot of people with type one who have their personal idea of normal as I want to eat everything in the middle aisles of the grocery store because that's what all my friends are doing. And I know for me, that was like drinking slushies from the gas station and eating pizzas and all the things that I would never do today. And to have that as like, you know, changing the definition of what food is normal from like a massive, like just raining it down from the sky, I feel like is going to have, that's where I see a lot of help for everyone to be had.
I think on that one note of food, like the biggest change I saw when I became celiacs was portions. Like the bread is at least half the size of normal bread. And it's like, so this is like what a normal portion should be. And it's just kind of crazy to think like everything's bigger and more and like more carbs, more sugar, whatever it is. And just thinking about like, what can we do kind of moving forward? I think it's, yeah, when you look at kind of everything up to more recently has been about just like the dependencies. How do you, you know, you can give yourself more insulin. How do you make that dependency a lot easier? Okay, you can read that blood sugar, but I love it in terms of what I saw. I think Mike's response to my letter was focusing on the education, because the education is, oh, it's actually like the way you eat your diet, these kind of foods, it's not just a diabetic issue. Like there are issues for everyone. I saw there was one article that came out about the different types of like oat milks, right? And I love oat milk. But I saw it was like one to avoid. And I was like, well, I get the sugar-free one. It says it has low carbs. And I've been curious like why my coffee was always kind of making my sugar go up. And that's a very helpful insight. You know, the way I have my coffee every morning, changing that can help actually make my morning even more steady. And so just, it's really taking it like you have more independent control, like just having that education, understanding those factors. And yes, will diabetics have more severe reactions? Yes, of course. Like your body's naturally like, it's all a guessing game. So if you don't guess right, your body's not going to be in normal state. But if you understand how any kind of body reacts too, it can just get more foods that are better for you for glucose out there more. Can make them more cost effective. It can make the CGM technology more cost effective. And just having more adoption and buy-in, Jesse, I totally agree. Like having people like actually talk about or understand, like if I said CGM 5 years ago, it's like, what's that? Like, and then you have to explain, okay, like, well, what's glucose, right? If like, if you're not a nurse or if you don't have a family member that doesn't have diabetes, like you probably don't know what it is. And now if there's just a lot more health implications because of it, that's just awesome. That's incredible. And so I think it's kind of taking it from moving away from the high level and the kind of ideological, but moving towards the practical. What's the implementation? How do you actually make real improvements for everyone? And then diabetics are able to, it's information that they can use. It is a direct path action they can take to improve their general livelihood and make it better.
Yeah, to kind of give my perspective, and I just so appreciate like hearing these stories, because my hope is that we really start to treat metabolic function as something that everyone, like you're saying, everyone is actually playing this game. It's just most people don't know that they are. And the more that we can expose that black box that everyone's tinkering with and they don't realize it, the more I think we can start to tackle the most pressing parts of that issue, and what I mean by that is the preventable chronic illness and the acute conditions, which require really constant monitoring and maintenance. But once we all have a better perspective on the fact that we're all on the same spectrum, we're all dealing with these issues, and there are things that society can optimize for: the food supply, the healthcare system, the insurance system, the political nature of subsidies that are driving many of these things. Once we're all kind of aware of, okay, these are the levers that are being pulled, and it doesn't just affect 1.5 million people with type 1 diabetes. It actually affects all of us. And like you're saying, you know, the choices we're making, the education we share is going to drive a narrative at the social scale. And I think the secondary effects, you know, my hope is that the secondary effects of more people who are empowered with their information, regardless of where they are on the metabolic function spectrum, will be more informed and thus individual activists pushing for a better future. And it doesn't matter if we all agree. I think we can all have different political perspectives and yet agree that insulin shouldn't be as expensive as it is, and that you shouldn't have to lobby for the right to have access to the data that is coming from your own body. You should own that information. And so whether that's a CGM for the management of diabetes or a CGM for better understanding of how you are aging and how well you are controlling your lifestyle, whether you're hitting your weight loss goals, your performance goals, both of those things are you interacting with the data from your body. So to try to inject some optimism into the future, you know, I hope that by opening up, you know, the old school supply and demand, you know, equation and putting it out there, I think we can really bring more eyes, many, many more eyes onto these problems. And so anyway, I'm just curious, like anything else to end on a positive note, like have you seen positive trends, anything that you're looking forward to, that you're seeing that is really giving you a good feeling about the future? And what can people do to get more informed, to try and boost the message and the signal for the type 1 community?
I think so much is like really being able to look at diabetes in a different light, in as like, I think kind of as Jesse and I said, like take the silver lining, right? It's not a death sentence. No, you can live a good, healthy life for the rest of your life and just make the kind of right choices. And what I've seen so much of online in like very, I would say, disconnected spheres is a lot more information sharing about glucose levels in general, in a good way, right? Like just general people taking to their health and having glucose be a lot more a part of that conversation. And naturally, when that's there, like diabetes are adjacent to that. And I think for the diabetic community is it's just to lean into that and like take what you can, right? Like it's okay if it's not directly about you, but you can still learn and benefit from it. There's plenty of other areas of life where other people do that too. And so if there's something that helps you, like it's fine if it's not about you, but take the positive learnings and go ahead. And just seeing so much more of that, whether it is on Instagram or LinkedIn or Facebook or whatever, like even just on the news, like you see it there, that's awesome. That means there's momentum, there's education around it. And then what's this kind of next order effects is once you see the cost of things, right? It's like, how do you actually get there? People have to know about it in order to fix it, and have to care about it in order to want to fix it. And so just having that kind of exposure there is really great. And having it be of all walks of life is incredible too. And so just keeping that positive message of it's not, all of this is not just for diabetics or it's just for non-diabetics, it's for everyone. It's general health and wellness that is applicable to, you know, anyone at any kind of stage of their life.
Yeah. And I'll offer a perspective from my day-to-day at Levels, which is about 50% in the member support queue. And it's so cool to be able to field conversations from people who have positively experienced change in their life. And not only that, but people who maybe putting on a CGM for the first time and saying, oh, but it's a different level for my finger stick glucose level. And then you sort of dive into it a little bit more and you're like, oh, well, you check this in the morning and there's a dawn phenomenon that we all have, or that some of us have, and your glucose will spike. And if you're capturing that comparison in that moment, then your finger stick is going to have a different value than your CGM. And so that's just one example of things where it's extracting a layer of like, oh, it's not the technology, but it's actually, this is how my body works. And I do have a spike in the morning, or my coffee spikes me. And yeah, so there are many beautiful examples of that, but that is one that I think captures it well.
Awesome. Well, you know, we've been at this for some time. Chris, I really appreciate you giving us the time and your perspective and background, and kind of, you know, I know this is something that you tend to keep more private. So I know sharing this with our audience, with our membership is really appreciated. I learned a ton. There's so many unique examples of life and all of these different identities that are formed, and all of them come down to a shared root of metabolic function and something that some of you deal with in a more consistent and more acute way than others. But I'm really grateful for your willingness to come and share your perspective and your experience. Looking forward to changing some of these things that we talked about today.
really appreciate it. I do think the future is bright, and I think Levels is playing a huge part in that. And I really think despite what, you know, whatever kind of responsiveness, people are always hesitant to change. And I think just kind of being able to see that net benefit, that education, just having all of that helpful information out there, it's nothing but good.